Okay, let's start. Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the Information Service in Geneva. Today is Tuesday, 9th of December, and I'd like to start immediately with Ricardo Pires and our guest that you know well, Tess Ingram, who is coming to us from Gaza. Tess, nice to see you again. Thank you very much for coming to tell us about the toll on maternal malnutrition and stress on newborn children at the moment in Gaza. I understand also that you are completing your assignment, and so we are particularly happy to have you here with us. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. Thanks for having me today. As you all well know, at least 165 children are reported to have died painful, preventable deaths related to malnutrition during the war in the Gaza Strip. But far less reported has been the scale of malnutrition among pregnant and breastfeeding women and the devastating domino effect that that has had on thousands of newborns. The pattern is clear. Malnourished mothers giving birth to underweight or premature babies who die in Gaza's neonatal intensive care units or survive only to face malnutrition themselves or potential lifelong medical complications. Let me first track back to 2022 in Gaza before the horrors of the last 2 years, when an average of 250 babies per month, or about 5%, were born with what doctors call low birth weight, or weighing less than 2.5 kilograms at birth. This is according to the Ministry of Health. In the first half of 2025, even with fewer births, more babies were born underweight, 10% of all births, or about 300 babies per month. And then in the 3 months before the ceasefire, July to September this year, this surged to an average of 460 babies every month, or 15 a day, which is almost double the pre-war average. In Gaza's hospitals, I have met several newborns who weighed less than 1 kilogram, their tiny chests heaving with the effort of staying alive. Low birth weight infants like these babies are about 20 times more likely to die than infants of normal weight. They need special care, which many of the hospitals in Gaza have struggled to provide due to the destruction of the health system, the death and displacement of staff, and impediments by Israeli authorities that prevented some essential medical supplies from entering the strip. The data shows that the number of babies who died on their first day of life in Gaza increased 75%, from an average of 27 babies per month in 2022 to 47 babies per month between July and September 2025. Not all of that can be traced back to preterm or low birth weight, but alongside congenital abnormalities, doctors tell me it is a common story. Low birth weight is generally caused by poor maternal nutrition, increased maternal stress, and limited antenatal care. In Gaza, we witness all three, and the response to them is not moving fast enough nor at the scale required. Between July and September, about 38% of the pregnant women that we screened with our partners were diagnosed with acute malnutrition, 38%. And even now, we continue treating them in high numbers. In October alone, we admitted 8,300 pregnant and breastfeeding women for treatment for acute malnutrition. That's about 270 women per day in a place where there was no discernible malnutrition among this group before October 2023. This pattern is a grave warning, and it will likely result in low birth weight babies being born in the Gaza Strip for months to come. This is not over. 2 weeks ago, I met Fatma as she was visiting her baby Mohammed in a Gaza City neonatal intensive care unit. Mohammed was born premature and weighing about 1.5 kilograms. Fatma told me that unlike her first pregnancy, when she had access to checkups, vitamins, and nutritious foods, I quote, "This pregnancy has been full of displacement, lack of food, malnutrition, war, and fear." She said she was malnourished for 3 months of the pregnancy, displaced 3 times, and her young daughter and husband were killed 2 months apart by airstrikes. I have spent many months in Gaza over the past 2 years, and I see and hear the generational impacts of the conflict on mothers and infants almost every day, in hospitals, in nutrition clinics, in family tents. It is less visible than the blood and injury, but it is ubiquitous. It is everywhere. I have lost count of the number of parents like Fatma who have sobbed while telling me what happened to them, wrecked by how powerless they are to protect their children in the face of indiscriminate destruction and deprivation. Generations of families, including those being born now into this ceasefire, have been forever altered by what was inflicted upon them. UNICEF is responding. We are replacing incubators, ventilators, and other life-saving equipment that was destroyed. We delivered 10 ventilators to Gaza in late September, and since the ceasefire, another 20 incubators, 20 ventilators, 15 patient monitors, among other equipment. Since the ceasefire, we've also provided supplements to over 45,000 pregnant and breastfeeding women to prevent malnutrition. We've screened over 150,000 children under five for acute malnutrition and enrolled over 14,000 in treatment. We're providing breastfeeding counselling for over 14,000 caregivers, as well as mental health and psychosocial support. We're doing everything in our power to support families, but to improve the response, more aid still needs to enter the Gaza Strip, especially aid that strengthens the health of pregnant and breastfeeding women and equips hospitals with everything that they need to save lives. This must be supplemented by commercial goods that restock local markets with enough nutritious foods so that the prices continue to fall. And the fear must end. This ceasefire should offer families safety, not more loss. More than 70 children have been killed in the 8 weeks since the ceasefire began. 70 children. The ongoing attacks and the killing of children must stop immediately. And finally, this domino effect from mother to child should have and could have been prevented. No child should be scarred by war before they have taken their first breath. But in Gaza, this brutal reality was caused by the conflict and exacerbated by the Israeli raid restrictions, which depleted hospitals and starved and stressed mothers. So much suffering could have been prevented if international humanitarian law had been respected. Thank you.
Thank you, Tess. Thank you very much for this important update. I'll open the floor to questions now. Cristiano Rick, DPA.
Sorry, this is the Lisa question. Can you please share your notes? Because you mentioned so many figures that it was difficult to keep up. Thank you.
The Lisa references to our journalist, the dean of journalists, who was always asked for written notes from the speakers. I love that you remind her in this way. Thank you very much. I'm looking to Ricardo to make sure that we will get test notes quickly. Emma Farge, Reuters.
Yes, good morning. I'm just interested in knowing a comparison. You mentioned the 8,300 pregnant and breastfeeding women, and that's since the ceasefire. So I was just wondering, how does that compare with at other stages in the war? Is it just as bad as it was during the war? And then secondly, a question on medevacs. There's real talk about Rafah finally opening for medevacs. Any sign that this is really happening? Are you getting children's names on a list and so on? And do you know if any children have actually died waiting since the ceasefire? I know that hundreds have died waiting since the war began. Thank you.
Thank you, Emma. I give the floor to Tess to answer you, but there is also Christian on the line in case he wants to add something on medevac. Tess?
Thank you. In terms of the number of women we've admitted for treatment, October is the highest number that we've recorded this year in 2025, and I can see if we have earlier data for you, Emma. One of the reasons that it is higher is because we are able to treat pregnant and breastfeeding women because we have the supplies now in order to do that. So that is a number that we're admitting for treatment because we are able to finally admit them for treatment. But it's also a reflection of how serious the situation has been perhaps this whole time, if the numbers even now are over 8,000. But in August, for example, they were 2,500, same in September.
Thank you. I don't see Christian who has head up. Okay, I saw Jeremy first, sorry. Oh, you had a follow-up, go ahead.
It was just on the medevacs.
On the medevacs, yeah.
I can say quickly that you know, it's estimated that about 4,000 children still require medical evacuation from the Gaza Strip, and I continue to meet families in hospitals who have the form, who are waiting for that medical evacuation for children, including last week a 2.5-year-old girl called Amaima, who has a congenital heart condition that requires surgery that's not possible here in Gaza, and she has gone into heart failure while she awaits that medical evacuation. We asked, I'm sure WHO can speak to this, but there have been some medical evacuations since the ceasefire, but we really need that to scale up, and Rafa is critical in that.
Yeah, and I see Christian has opened his camera. Christian, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, thank you very much. And also, Tess, thank you for the lead on this. Indeed, so medical evacuations are a complex procedure. Let's not forget that. So this is a long line of medical referrals, of security clearance by the Israeli authorities at the very last step, but most importantly also of receiving countries to be willing and be able to receive children, women, men, all those need to be evacuated. On the numbers now, I only have the total right now in front of me. So we have a total of more than 10,620 patients evacuated since October 2023, and that is until 1 December, so until a few days ago. And out of those, 5,608 children. And yes, there are many more waiting. Children and people have died while waiting for the medical procedures, while waiting to be evacuated. It's a long process, and we're grateful, really grateful, for every country which only receives a single patient who so badly need to be evacuated because there's no medical treatment available for them inside Gaza.
Thank you very much, Christian. Jeremy and then Robin. Jeremy Lange, RFI.
Yeah, thank you. I apologize because I feel like I've been asked this question like so many times since the war started. But you mentioned like the lack of food. Technically speaking, like do pregnant women are actually starving to death as we speak? Children are starving to death, and could the opening of the Rafah border could it be a game changer to that point of view?
The rate of malnutrition among children and breastfeeding is remaining stubbornly high. We admitted 9,300 children under 5 for treatment for malnutrition in October. And as I said, more than 8,000 pregnant and breastfeeding women. Those numbers are dramatically higher than the February ceasefire. For example, the number of children admitted is 5 times higher than in February. So we need to see the numbers come down further, and the opening of the Rafah crossing, if that allowed the flow of humanitarian trucks as we want it to, could be important in helping us bring down those numbers of children with malnutrition. We really need to see all types of aid come in, particularly nutritious food, through commercial routes as well, because when I'm talking to families here in nutrition clinics, something that is continuously coming up is that mothers cannot afford to buy their children the nutritious food that's available in the markets. Fruits and vegetables, which are now here, remain very expensive, and animal products like dairy and meat even more so. For example, a UNICEF market survey done in November found that meat still on average costs about US$20 a kilo. So most families can't access this, and that's why we're still seeing high rates of malnutrition. Unfortunately, the rate of malnutrition among pregnant and breastfeeding women is slower to come down, we're seeing, than among children. And that's because mothers are really sacrificing their own well-being in order to feed their children. I met a mother in a nutrition clinic a couple of weeks ago. She's got 2 kids. She's 9 months pregnant with her 3rd child. Her name's Noor, and she's 24 years old. She had severe acute malnutrition, and we've been treating her for that, and she is improving, but she remains malnourished now, just 2 weeks before giving birth to the baby. And she was saying to me that in the, you know, darkest days of the famine a few months ago, she was surviving on half a piece of pita bread, giving the rest to her children. And even now, the supplies that she gets from us to treat her malnutrition, she's giving them to her children as well. And this is a common story here of mothers really kind of sacrificing their own nutrition to help support their children.
Robin, AFP.
Thank you. 2 months, we're now 2 months into the ceasefire. What impediments are you currently seeing in terms of getting into the Gaza Strip, the things that that you need to tackle this situation? And if there are any impediments, do you see any signs of that situation improving?
I'll take that in reverse. So we have seen an improvement, but there are still impediments. The improvement we've measured in the volume of aid that we're collecting on the Gaza side of the crossing. So, for example, in the 10 weeks leading into the ceasefire, we were picking up on average about 1,100 pallets of aid a week. At the moment, on average, since the ceasefire, in the last 8 weeks, it's been 3,800 pallets a week. So that's about a 250% increase in the volume of aid that UNICEF has been able to pick up inside Gaza. That's positive, but of course we're coming off an incredibly low base and it's still nowhere near enough. What we want to be able to do is, now talking about, you know, the trucks that we're offloading, we're approved by the Israeli authorities to offload between 55 and 60 trucks on the Israeli side of the Gaza crossing every day. But at the moment, because of the various constraints, we're only offloading an average of about 38 trucks. So we could increase the volume of aid we're offloading, which would mean that we're collecting more aid every day inside Gaza. The impediments really remain as they were before. As I said, we're still seeing airstrikes and shelling, so the insecurity remains an issue. Customs clearance challenges remains a big issue, as do delays and denials of cargo at the crossing. And then the limited routes for transporting humanitarian supplies inside Gaza. These are still coordinated missions in which we have to receive approval to go and collect the aid from the crossings. And we're often funneled through particular routes that are congested or insecure. So again, we have seen some improvement, but we continue to call for all of the available crossings into the Gaza Strip to be open and for them to be open simultaneously, not, you know, for example, as we're seeing at the moment, the crossings alternating between offloading and collection, so only being open every other day. We need them all open consistently so that aid can come through, and then for the processes of that aid moving through the various clearances to be expedited if we're really serious about addressing the massive needs that we're seeing under this ceasefire.
Thank you very much. John Zarokostas, France 24, and the Lancet.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for this briefing. I was wondering if you could give us some more details on the 9,300 children that were admitted in October for treatment. Was that for severe acute malnutrition? And how many have recovered and how many have passed away? And secondly, with reference to the goods coming in and all the impediments, are the UNICEF supplies coming in free of import duties, or are they subjected to import duties? Thank you.
On the question on the number of children with malnutrition, so the 9,300 children admitted in October is down from a peak in August and then again from September, but it's still a shockingly high number. In terms of how many of those children were acutely malnourished, all of them, this is all for children with acute malnutrition. I don't have data to hand on how many have recovered. Generally, our treatment is 8 weeks. So if a child's admitted to treatment, this is for outpatient treatment at these numbers, they come on a weekly basis to collect the ready-to-use therapeutic food, which is the treatment, and they do that over a course of 6 to 8 weeks. So it's safe to say that most of those children are probably still in the treatment. In terms of how many have died, this is a number that's kept track by the Palestinian Ministry of Health, and the last number I had was 165 children since the beginning of October 2020, since October 2023. On import duties, I would need to check that for you unless Ricardo knows the answer to that.
He doesn't, so he will check maybe, or you will check this. That's so, thank you very, very much for being with us. I know it has been, Emma, just down, we have the last one, please, because
thank you.
We have to go to Sri Lanka.
Yeah, thank you, Tessa. I just wanted to ask the child with congenital heart disease who had heart failure, what happened to her? That was a clarification. And then just a broader sort of more human question. You've been in Gaza for almost the entire conflict. I was just wondering on your personal reflections on leaving it for the last time and what sort of place you're leaving behind. Thank you.
So on Omaima, the 2.5-year-old girl, we've been trying to follow up with the family. Last we heard, she was in a critical condition in a hospital here in the middle area of Gaza, still awaiting medical evacuation. On leaving Gaza, I think the takeaway for me is that this is unfortunately, sadly, not over. And that's because, you know, over the last 2 years, I think I've seen some of the very best and very worst of humanity. And one of the things that has struck me the most, Emma, is that there were days when people would say to me, tell the world that we're people, that we are families, and that we just want to live, that this is not our war. And it was more than once, it was many times, people would beg me to use my role as a spokesperson to tell the world that they are like you, that they are families with children, and that those children were being killed in their sleep or starved to death, but also affected in a myriad of other ways. And that's why I wanted to talk about maternal and newborn health today, because it's a very clear example of what has been inflicted on families here and what I've seen consistently, which is the big blasts and the mass deaths, but also the small, deep cuts that ripple through every generation of a family, deliberately destroying life, dignity, and possibility. And I think families watched in Gaza as the rules meant to protect them as civilians in war, the bedrock of international law were broken and injustice was normalized. And it compelled them to feel like they had to remind us all that they too are families. So I think I leave a place where people really are asking to continue to receive support, to continue to receive international recognition and accountability for what has happened. And we are still seeing, unfortunately, the rules of war being broken. So the world cannot switch off now. This ceasefire has to become a real peace for the families in Gaza.
Tess, thank you so very much, really, for your work, exceptional work, and thanks for being the voice of all these children and families. You've been fantastic also with our Geneva Press Corps, so thanks again for being here constantly and reporting on that. And I mean, look at Ricardo, because I'm sure he will make sure that you get the notes very, very quickly. Thank you so much. So let's go to our next speaker, who has been patiently waiting from Colombo. Sarah has brought us Azusa Kubota, the resident representative of UNDP. Sarah, you want to start?
Yeah, just a few words, just to say that Azusa is going to present the result of a rapid damage assessment that UNDP has prepared on the floods. I sent you the press release and the link to the report and the result yesterday. So make sure that you check your spam if you don't see it. Thank you.
So I give the floor to Azusa for our introductory remarks.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today. Am I audible, I hope?
We can hear you well, and we can see you well.
Very good, thank you. I want to begin by expressing our solidarity with all the communities affected by the recent floods and landslides following Cyclone Ditwa. The disaster is a stark reminder of the growing climate risks that the country faces. And there's an urgent need for us to strengthen resilience. As already mentioned, the United Nations Development Program, in collaboration with the government, just launched a rapid assessment to better understand the scale and the urgency of this crisis. An estimated 2.3 million people were living in areas flooded by Cyclone Ditwa that struck Sri Lanka. 638 people have lost their lives, and 191 people still missing as of this morning. And the last, the biggest floods that we experienced in a country in 2016 had the death toll of 93. So you can see the scale of this disaster. The analysis shows flood waters from the cyclone inundated more than 1.1 million hectares, which is 1/5 or 20% of the country's land area, and caused significant damage to homes, infrastructure, and essential services. Over 1,209 landslides have been registered. Ududumara, Secretariat in Kandy District, which is in the middle part of the country, highland, by far the most landslide at 135. Other secretariats like Lagagara, Kotumare, East, and Lugnara and Pasara all registered over 60 landslides each. And as we all know, landslides can isolate at-risk communities and disrupt access to essential services and relief efforts. And if the rain persists and continues to come, these communities continue to be exposed to high risks. So we've got to make sure access to these communities as soon as possible. And more than half of the people, I would say 54% of the people in the flooded areas are already living in households facing multiple vulnerabilities before the cyclone. You must know that the country has gone through the country's worst economic crisis in 2022, and these communities are still recovering from multiple challenges such as unstable income, high levels of debt, and limited ability to cope with climate-induced disasters. So the scale is staggering. One in every 12 buildings in Sri Lanka was touched by flood waters, and more than 16,000 kilometers of roads are exposed, enough to circle around this island nation 12 times, disrupting transport, market access, and recovery operations. Over 278 kilometers of railways exposed to cyclone-related flooding. And as of this morning, I understand 70% of them are not operational. This also includes 35 railroad bridges nationwide. So another crisis within the crisis unfolding. Over 60% of all exposed people are concentrated in the capital city of Colombo, capital district of Colombo, and Gambaha districts, placing immense pressure on essential services and local systems. And it is also estimated that Cyclone Ditwa has exposed over 530,000 hectares of rice paddies to flooding across Sri Lanka, and we are just about to go into harvesting season. Given that 30% of the population works directly in the agriculture sector and 80% of work directly in the indirectly in the sector, you can understand this has direct impact on the livelihoods of many. So the findings are sobering, and what this means is clear. Many of the hardest hit areas are already among the most vulnerable nationwide. Climate shocks are outpacing our current capacity to adapt. And without decisive action right now, these hazards would deepen vulnerabilities and reverse Padawan development gains over the years. So UNDP is committed to supporting both immediate relief and long-term sustainable recovery. Priorities are to restore basic services, strengthen local capabilities, and direct resources to the areas with the most urgent needs. And our goal is not just to recover. We want to make sure we build resilience while we do that, so the communities can withstand further shocks and thrive. I was visiting some of the affected communities in the Colombo district, and these families live in the most vulnerable climate zones, disaster-prone zones, and they keep going back to those very precarious locations. We've got to think about relocation, bring them to a safe habitat, and also build their resilience so that they will not be exposed to these climate shocks in the future. So this is a pivotal moment for the country and for the government. And the choices we make now will determine whether Sri Lanka moves towards resilience or faces recurring setbacks. So thank you so much for listening. Back to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you really very much, Azusa, for this update. Let me look at the room. Is there any question for UNDP on Sri Lanka? I don't see any hand up in the room or on the platform. I don't see any hand up, so thank you very, very much for this update. Sarah, as Sarah said, you have the material, so if you don't have it, let her know. but it's very important that we continue speaking about what is the situation in Sri Lanka. Thank you very much. Thanks, Sarah, and thanks, Azusa. Let us go to another crisis, also on the situation of maternal health. And women and girls situation, this time with Fabrizia Falcione. Pernille, I don't know if you want to come to the podium. Fabrizia Falcione is the UNFPA representative in Sudan, and she's reaching out from Port Sudan to tell us about the situation in Northern State and Khartoum. Fabrizia, you have the floor. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and good morning. And indeed, I'm speaking to you from Port Sudan, where I just returned after a visit to the northern state, including Al-Afad displacement camp, which is near Al-Daba, where thousands of people, mostly women and children, have fled after escaping the brutal violence in Al-Fashir, North Darfur. And if this war had a face, this would definitely be the face of a woman. These women and girls have survived 540 days under siege in Al-Fashir. I met in my visit with a group of pregnant women. A few had just delivered their babies. Not one woman I met with had a single antenatal care consultation before that day. They told me that they preferred not to go to the hospital rather than risking their lives and those of their babies while trying to reach it. They also told me that they had to sell everything that they owned to afford the trip. Many were robbed of all their possessions, and one woman told me, I had to sell my land to escape. I lost my husband, and now I have nothing left. And the great majority of the pregnant women I met with, they in fact had lost their husbands. They were either killed or disappeared. And these women are now the breadwinners for their families, but they have nothing left and don't have an income. Now, after these dangerous journeys, they arrived in Al-Afad camp, where even the basics are very limited. And when I asked these pregnant women what they needed the most, they all said toilets. Now, in my 19 years in the UN as a humanitarian, I have never heard women and pregnant women saying toilets as the first need. No toilets anywhere near their tents. No lights in the camp at night. And these are pregnant women who have remained without men in their households. So you can imagine that the protection risks are huge. Bread was actually the second thing that they mentioned, which was then followed by a way to earn a living. Now, some of these pregnant women just arrived from Darfur, and they were waiting outside the camp to receive a tent. I also met a 17-year-old girl, and she was holding her 40-day-old baby, which was born out of rape. Now, this is an extraordinary act of strength of any woman, let alone an adolescent girl. She had arrived at the camp a few days before, and she had never before received any antenatal care before giving birth. UNFPA also supports safe spaces for women and girls in Al-Afad as well as across Sudan. Several of the displaced women I met, they were doctors, they were nurses, midwives, teachers, and today they are struggling to simply survive, but some of them are also being able to be employed in the camp and use their skills to support other women. Now, also an 18-year-old girl who had recently arrived from Tawila in Darfur, she said, I should have never left Al-Fashir. And I hope that her words are a message to the international community, because we can and we must do better. In terms of UNFPA response, UNFPA is providing maternal and obstetric care for women, as well as case management and psychosocial services for survivors of gender-based violence in Al-Afad camp, in Tawila, and across Sudan, through the reproductive health services and in the safe spaces where we provide counseling, life skills, and referral for survivors of gender-based violence. Now, these services are a lifeline, but only if they can continue. And in 2025, UNFPA only received 42% of the humanitarian response. This means that safe spaces were shattered, supplies cut, and some support to the reproductive health care had also to be stopped. In 2026, we're appealing for $116 million for Sudan as UNFPA, and we need full funding of this appeal to be able to respond. This war is an assault on the rights, health, and dignity of women and girls, with 12.1 million people at risk of gender-based violence. So leaders must act now to prevent further atrocities. And finally, we think that also you as the media have an important role to play. And so please don't let the people of Sudan suffer in silence, because the world must know the needs that they have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Fabrizia. I will, that's really a very, very dire situation in this region. I open the floor to questions now in the room. Emma Farge, Reuters.
Good morning. I was hoping you could say a bit more about the mothers of babies of rape in Sudan, since sexual violence has been so widespread and access to abortion is low, I believe, in Sudan. I'm wondering if you could say something about this community. Do you know how many there are, roughly, and are they getting the support that they need? Thank you.
Fabrizia? Wait, we can't hear you now.
Yeah, thank you. Sorry.
You're on.
Thank you. This is also a UNFPA immediate and direct concern, to be honest, the mothers of the babies born out of rape. In terms of the numbers, we do not have numbers, but what I can tell you is that the numbers are not, the actual numbers are not something important. We know that there has been massive cases of rape. Also, any number that we would give would be under reporting. Why? Because first of all, there is fear of stigmatization, because services are not as widespread. You know, the data can only be collected through the services. So honestly, the numbers would not be important and not the issue right now. In terms of the mothers of the babies, this is a longer term need. And as UNFPA, something that we are starting to work as of now, these women have been raped in a few months. Some of them will give birth. Some of them, because of previous rapes, they've already given birth. We have to think about their mental health, their psychosocial support. We have to think about their income. These are all services that we can provide through the life-saving services related directly to the response to gender-based violence. It is possible to give them. We're also supporting care providers themselves to increase their capacity. We're also putting in place a service to provide support to healthcare providers, because they themselves are traumatized. So yes, the mothers are of the newborn babies and babies born out of rape are our concern. And so all the services that we are providing to the survivors of violence, we are going to continue them, and we're also increasing our mental health and psychosocial support for them as a part of the response.
Thank you very much, Fabrizia. Other questions to UNFPA online? I don't see any, so thanks a lot. Please go ahead.
Thank you, everyone. If there are any other questions or follow-up, please don't hesitate to reach out to me. And then I also just want to take the opportunity to say that next week UNFPA will have our global launch of our 2026 Humanitarian Action Overview, and that will take place online Thursday next week, the 11th, from 3 to 4. And I'm happy, together with the notes, also to share a link to that so you can all tune into it. It's going to be in online launch with the UNFPA Executive Director, Diana Kette. So just want to let you know about that.
Thank you very much, Pernille. That's important. So if you can send the link to all the journalists, it would be very useful. Thanks again. Thanks to Fabrizia. Let's stay on violence against women and girls with UN Women. Whom I'm inviting to join me. And I see that Sophia is online. Welcome. So we have our colleagues of UN Women today to tell us about their report of online violence against women, human rights defenders, activists, and journalists on International Human Rights Day, which, as you know, is going to be tomorrow. So I don't know who would like to start.
Here. Yes. Good morning, please. And thank you.
Bialitz Osman.
Thank you.
Policy specialist.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for being here today for this briefing on online violence against women in the public sphere. The report that we're presenting today was developed by UN Women under the EU-funded Act to End Violence Against Women and Girls program. And it's a collaboration that we've developed together with our research partners at the NERV, City St. George's University, and the International Center for Journalists under the leadership of Dr. Julie Pozzetti, who's here with us today. Tomorrow, as the world wraps up the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence and looks towards International Human Rights Day, we're reminded that women's rights are human rights. Yet today, in the era of AI, those rights, especially the right to safety, to participation, and freedom of expression, are under unprecedented threat in the digital sphere. Our new report, Tipping Point, the chilling escalation of online violence against women in the public sphere, reveals that the very women who put themselves on the line every day to defend our human rights and inform the public are some of the groups of women that are at the greatest risk of digital violence. And this violence has reached a tipping point, one that threatens not only individual women, but also democratic participation, civic space, and the human rights of all women and girls. Let me start with the headline finding of the research. Our global survey found that 70% of women human rights defenders, women's rights activists, and women journalists experienced online violence in the course of their work. That's 7 in 10 women whose job it is to tell the truth, to hold power to account, and to speak up for our rights that have experienced online violence. But perhaps the most alarming finding is that our research shows that what starts online doesn't stay online. Around 4 in 10 respondents, that's 41% overall, reported offline harm, abuse, harassment, or attacks linked to online violence. This tells us something simple but very serious. Online violence is not virtual. It's a very real form of violence with very real world consequences. The third significant finding is that when we look specifically at women journalists and media workers, the picture gets even starker. A 2020 global survey conducted by the International Center for Journalists and published in collaboration with UNESCO found that 20% of women journalists had experienced offline attacks connected to online violence. In our new 2025 survey that underpins this report, that figure has now risen to 42%. In other words, the number of women journalists who experience offline harm connected to their experience of online abuse has more than doubled in just 5 years. This signals that laws, policies, and protection measures have failed to keep pace with the growing threats of online violence. Finally, the report also documents the impact of new technologies, especially generative AI, on violence against women. Almost 1 in 4 respondents reported AI-assisted online violence. Such tools are being weaponized to sexualize women, to discredit them, and to intimidate them into silence. It's now much easier and cheaper to produce abusive content such as deepfake sexual imagery, manipulated videos, and AI-generated disinformation, as well as to distribute it at scale through algorithms that are designed to amplify hate and maximize profits of tech companies. The effects of these online harms are devastating for women, both individually and collectively. Victims, survivors of digital violence experience trauma, depression, anxiety, self-harm, suicide, and we see that there are also growing links to femicide and gender-related killings. Online violence limits women's public participation and leadership as women's voices are silenced, censored, and discredited. We see that many women withdraw from the public sphere or step back from their activism and in some cases leave their professions altogether. And there are also intergenerational impacts as young women and girls may be deterred from entering professions such as journalism and politics. So when this happens at scale, it's not just a women's rights issue, it becomes a democratic crisis. If women's voices are pushed out of our public debates, our societies are less informed, less representative, and as a result, they're less free. So what needs to change? First, we need to end impunity. Currently, fewer than 40% of countries have laws that address digital violence. This means that nearly 2 billion women and girls have no legal protection from online harassment or cyberstalking. So we need to see stronger laws and policies that recognize digital violence as real violence and as a human rights violation, and that provide the same protections to women online that are available offline. And we also need to see effective implementation and enforcement of these laws, including with adequate budgets. Second, we need to ensure that there are specific measures in place to address the heightened risks that women in public life, such as women human rights defenders, women's rights activists, and women journalists face. And this includes robust reporting systems and survivor-centered rapid response mechanisms. And finally, we need to see greater investments in prevention and in transforming social norms. Like all forms of violence against women and girls, digital violence is not inevitable. It can and must be prevented through investing in education programs, through social norm change, and through engaging men and boys as allies. Online safety can no longer be an afterthought. It must be designed into platforms and products from the start. The tech sector has an important role to play in ensuring safety by design and in testing digital tools and products before they're released to ensure that they don't have negative or unintended consequences for women and girls. At UN Women, we're intensifying our work in this area. Through the Act to End Violence Against Women programme, we're supporting women's rights organisations to strengthen their digital resilience and their capacities to push for legal reform and accountability from tech companies. Today, we're also pleased to announce the launch of our new corporate strategy to prevent and respond to tech-facilitated violence against women, which focuses on strengthening accountability, closing data and evidence gaps, accelerating prevention and survivor-centered responses, as well as building greater resilience and amplifying the voices of women's rights movements and women leaders. Let me just end with this message. The women whose experiences are reflected in this report are not just survivors of violence, they're essential voices in our public life. Protecting them from violence, whether online or offline, is not optional. It's a prerequisite for human rights, for gender equality, and for healthy democracies. Thank you very much, and we look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Osman. And I believe you would like to add something. Your mic, please.
Whoops.
Yep.
Hi, everybody. I'm Julie Pizzetti. I am Professor of Journalism at City University in London. I've been a journalist for over 30 years, and I've been studying gender-based online violence against women, in particular women journalists, for about 15 years now. I also lead the newly established Information Integrity Initiative, which is a part of The Nerve, which is a digital forensics lab established by Maria Ressa, the Nobel laureate, who is one of the journalists that we studied it for The Chilling, which was the UNESCO study in 2020, which gave rise to this survey, which we are launching today. And one thing that we haven't said yet is that we need to understand this escalating crisis. We've called the report The Tipping Point. The previous study for UNESCO was called The Chilling because of the way it chilled freedom of expression and women's rights. This is the tipping point where this combination of artificial intelligence, the mainstreaming of artificial intelligence technologies, which are so much cheaper, so much faster, so much easier to access, We have, in combination with that challenge, a rise in authoritarianism and the mainstreaming of misogyny and the networked nature of misogyny. So we see autocrats and authoritarian leaders weaponizing misogyny, particularly against women in public life, using gender-based online violence against women journalists, human rights defenders and activists as a way of silencing them and attempting to push them out of public life with a specific purpose of placing them at greater risk, which, again, to underscore that statistic of, in the case of women journalists, 42% have experienced offline harm connected to online violence. For the women human rights defenders and activists, that figure, although it hasn't doubled over 5 years, is even higher at 44%. So I really would encourage you to dig into the study. It's very short, and to ask as many questions as you have at this point.
Just seeing a question on the chat, has the material been sent to the journalists? Maybe Sophia has an answer to that.
The report, the question, sorry?
If it has been, the material has been distributed to the journalists. I understand, yes.
Okay. The report is supposed to have been distributed when the embargo lifted at 10:30, yes.
Okay, so great.
On our website. Yeah. On the UN website, UN Women website, and also on the NERVS website. Yeah.
Okay. So let's open the floor to question. The Spanish News Agency.
Hi, thank you. I'm Alicia Agar from Spanish News Agency. I wanted to know, how do you determine or how do you measure which offline attacks are related to online violence? And also, if you could tell us if you are worried by a specific countries or context.
Yes. So the survey covers women, human rights defenders, journalists and activists in 119 countries. I haven't mentioned that before, so I think that's worth noting. It's a purposive survey, meaning that we distributed it through trusted networks to avoid it being weaponized. So within UN Women, UNESCO, the International Center for Journalists and so on. When it comes to the specific question about the trajectory of online violence to offline harm, we gave participants the opportunity to identify a range of different examples. And we also provided them with a description of what that could include. It goes to stalking, for example, physical assault, sexual assault. We also had respondents indicating swatting, which is a really egregious form of online violence where a mob, after a mob surge in attacks against a woman target, a false report is made to a police service, a rapid response police service. It comes from the term used in the US to SWAT, to send the SWAT team. And, you know, the police turn up at the door of the woman being targeted, responding to a false report of a violent crime, placing the woman at significant risk as a result of the police intervention. So it's a whole range of offline activities. But what our research previously has shown is that online violence also creates the enabling environment for lawfare. So in the case of people like Maria Ressa, she was targeted in a long-running campaign designed to discredit her as a journalist and to falsely paint her as a criminal. And that laid the scene for her persecution, prosecution, and ultimate conviction on a bogus charge of cyber libel. So we were able to trace, in that historic case, the use of a hashtag, bring her to the Senate, and the use of criminal in association with those hashtags to the campaign to see that she was painted as a criminal. And so we see the use of disinformation tactics very effectively. And one case that I think we should mention, which is very important and which, although we haven't published it yet, is the subject of a big data case study that my team and I have produced. And that's on Daphne Caruana Galizia, who is the murdered investigative journalist from Malta. And the public inquiry found in her case that the years of online violence directed at her, even though she was not herself on social media platforms, she was targeted, she was threatened, she was subjected to dehumanising abuse and so on. And the public inquiry found a connection between this campaign of online violence and ultimately her assassination. So this is a really dangerous and potentially deadly trajectory that we're looking at here, and we must take it very seriously. Your other question about which countries, sorry, just to answer
if
that.
It was a specific countries that.
Yes. So at the moment, what we've done is to analyse the data at the global level. We have not yet had an opportunity to break it down into country level data. We will be looking at the regional level first across the regions, and we have three other reports to come. So this will be released iteratively.
Okay. Very important. Robin, AFP.
Thank you. The people who are doing this, the people who are perpetrating this online violence and abuse and harassment to silence people, but what is the, have you identified, what is the ultimate goal behind them seeking to do that? And secondly, I assume that we're talking here mostly about men being behind this, but are there cases of women doing this as well? Thank you.
Yeah. I keep thinking I've left it on. It's been automatically turned off. Pardon me. I mean, there are a range of different perpetrators. We see presidents and prime ministers perpetrating this. I mean, there's the case, well-documented case, of the former president of Brazil, Bolsonaro, who targeted the journalist Patricia Campos Mello very viciously with highly sexualized online violence. His son did as well. She sued him successfully, ultimately won her case for that conduct. The point is, though, that in those cases, it's about trying to chill, in the case of journalists and human rights defenders in particular, chill the accountability work that they're doing, to silence them, to suppress the criticism. And we see examples of international leaders across the board. The Philippines is another example where Duterte used this strategy very effectively against Maria Ressa, who I mentioned. But we also see circumstances in the United States now where the president is referring to women journalists in his presence as piggy, you know, and telling them to be quiet and calling them stupid. And this is part of what I refer to as a continuum of violence against women, or the enabling of violence against women in public life. So when a president or a prime minister or some senior official makes such egregious comments, it tends to stir up the mob online. It's not even a dog whistle, which is a kind of subtle way of triggering a mob reaction. It's an overt attack. And then you have very specific examples of networked misogyny. So where you have, you know, the incel movement, influencers like Andrew Tate and others who are practicing digital misogyny as a way of furthering their campaign to limit women's rights. So it's part of a global campaign to roll back rights. And this rollback of gender rights is associated with authoritarianism. And so we see that there are definitely kind of political objectives here. But for some, targeting women in public life is simply about, you know, egregious expressions of sexism, which a desire to shut women up. You know, so depending on the perpetrator, the motives are distinct. But again, what this specific study shows is the connection between physical realm harms and the dramatic increase in the rate of those risks, particularly for women journalists, but the very stark exposure of women in public life broadly to that specific risk. And I just want to finalise by saying that this points to the really urgent need to reinforce effective regulatory mechanisms. Notwithstanding pressures to defend, you know, billionaire tech barons from any kind of accountability, we urgently need the rights and protections that under international law exist to preserve the rights of women journalists, human rights defenders, and others acting in the public interest to be enforced online as well as offline, which is a position that the UN Secretary General himself has taken.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you so much, Alessandra. Just to add also that I think, in addition to what Julie's just said, we know relatively little about perpetration. We're exploring one of the questions in the survey does ask about perpetration, but UN Women separately is also undertaking some research to better understand men's pathways into perpetration of online and offline violence, to better understand how the manosphere and these online misogynistic networks are now infiltrating and permeating mainstream social media platforms and drawing in young men and boys. So this is another piece of research that we're undertaking, because we do recognize that this is a key gap in terms of finding the prevention pathways. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't see other... Oh, yes, sorry. Jimmy Keaton, Associated Press Online.
Thank you very much for that. I just wanted to follow up on what you just said, Ms. Osman, about the research that's being done. What can you tell us now that has been turned up that has been effective in combating these? I mean, are there tools? Because at the end of the day, I mean, Ms. Pacetti, of course, mentioned, strengthening the sort of the legal frameworks and the regulatory frameworks. But I mean, what else can be done? What are some concrete things that the governments and others and politicians can do to help crack down on these problems? Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for that question. I think that's a really important point, because whilst it's true that laws and regulation is really important, I think there's a lot of education programs, social norm change programs, and looking at how we can engage men and boys as allies, as bystanders, and there are some really promising practices in terms of, engaging with men and boys through safer and more healthy online platforms, and working through different influencers that perhaps can present sort of counter narratives to what the predominant sort of manosphere and incel narratives are. So there are some promising practices, and we do believe that there needs to be a lot more investment in engaging with men and boys as allies and in creating safe and healthy education programs and initiatives to provide sort of counter narratives around these dominant discourse on backlash on gender equality. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, sure.
And I think the other important point to note in terms of foreign policy, for example, or domestic policy, is that this could be understood, as a form of extremism. So we need to think of radicalization among sort of radical misogynists as a security threat. So it's certainly a threat to women's participation in public life and to gender equality, but it's also, as research is increasingly indicating, one of the pathways to extremism. So men are radicalised along the lines of misogyny, which is why Yuliz mentioned UN Women is doing this really important work trying to understand what those pathways look like and so on. But if we think about networked misogyny as a threat that is a form of domestic terrorism, if you like, in the same way we think of domestic violence, then perhaps that helps change the strategy around those issues. And I just want to draw attention to my colleague, Professor Leah Hellmuller from City University, who's one of the co-authors of this report, and she and I are also working on something which is responsive, the question around what else can be done, which is a system called the Online Violence Early Warning System, which is our attempt to use AI technologies to monitor and detect and then ultimately help prevent the escalation of online violence to offline harm through a series of alerts that are issued according to our research-informed indicators for this kind of escalation. So this is a real-time monitoring system which we continue to work on, which has been supported by the UK government. So there's lots of creative work going around trying to develop technologies and develop systems, human rights by design systems, that try to counter the systems that are facilitating this violence, which are systems built by the blokes referred to as members of the broligarchy, so the incredibly wealthy men who control largely US-based big tech companies, and obviously the work that needs to be done in terms of supporting groups that do work with men, particularly young men, as we see this sort of divergence in attitudes towards women's rights along age lines. But we have to be conscious of the need to continue along the regulatory and legislative pathway, because we cannot simply outsource the solutions to those who are the primary targets and those who are allies of the primary targets.
Jamie, you have a follow-up, and then I'll go to John. Then we go to you.
Yeah, Paula. Ms. Osman, thank you so much, and both of, to both of you. You just mentioned that there were some counter-narratives that were out there that seemed promising. I was just wondering if you could just sort of give us some a few examples of that. And, you know, if you could think, I know that there's not one size fits all, but it'd be great to kind of amplify, you know, which kind of platforms are working, or which kind of voices are working. And for Ms. Pezzetti, just on that, I mean, obviously you may hear my accent of United States. I mean, the vibe in the United States in the last few years has been about more free speech, about unfettered speech, about and the regulatory aspect has been, let's say, brushed aside in a lot of cases. So is there, and maybe your colleague from City University could say something about that, but, you know, where is the promise, where's the hope on the U.S. side? Thanks.
Thank you. So to respond to the question about promising practices, we've seen initiatives, for example, through the Men Engage Network, where they're working with partner organizations such as Tales of Turning, where they develop content that the members of their network are posting in different online platforms with the view of engaging men and boys through positive narratives and positive messages around gender equality and women's rights. There's also other initiatives that have been developed by our partners such as Equimundo, again really working with their own networks of member organizations that put out into the social media platforms different sort of more engaging messages to try and divert men and boys away from the manosphere, but rather to engage in conversations about women's rights, about ending violence against women, about their role as male allies. And also UN Women has the He for She initiative, which is also an initiative that tries to promote male allyship. And whilst it's not specifically focused on online communities, it's also a model that could be replicated in online spaces. And I think there's just so much that has happened offline that we can use the power of social media and online and digital platforms, as Julie was saying, to use tech for good and use the power of AI and digital tools to amplify some of the promising and good practices in offline spaces that can be used in online spaces. Thank you.
Leah, feel free to... Okay. Just to add to what Yili said, one of the struggles we have is that, you know, 10, 15 years ago, we talked about social media for social good and the power of kind of network democracy. Now we are in a situation where algorithmically extreme narratives, sexist, misogynistic narratives, other forms of hate speech are being prioritised algorithmically. So it's very hard to use these tools for good. So just to that really... valid question about the inverted narratives around freedom of expression in the US, and I've written extensively about this before for the study The Chilling for UNESCO and elsewhere. It is a disingenuous misinterpretation of international freedom of expression rights. There is no right to commit hate speech under international law. This is a freedom of expression issue, but freedom of expression has been weaponized as a tool to suppress the voices of women, human rights defenders, journalists, activists, and not just women, but of course all of those who seek to uphold human rights in digital spaces. It is a false dichotomy. The international standards must be applied, and we see an escalation in this false argument that somehow the First Amendment supports unfettered speech. There are limitations under international law for freedom of expression, and the freedom of expression rights, if we just take women journalists, for example, include their right to practice journalism safely and freely everywhere. And that includes online, and that's been reaffirmed by the United Nations. And we cannot continue to enable the profiteering-oriented arguments of big tech companies that allege that any attempt to hold them accountable for what occurs on their sites is an attack on freedom of expression. Actually, it's about attempting to enforce human rights online as they are practiced offline, those standards and those rights. And we see just this week an increase in the rhetoric that suggests that here in Europe, for example, US foreign policy should go so far as to dissuade efforts to continue to regulate big tech companies. So this is an information war. I mean, I really think information integrity is the biggest battle that we face currently. And this issue of gender-based online violence is at the core, at the crux of that struggle.
Absolutely. And that makes me remind you that in June 2024, the United Nations published, in fact, it was endorsed by all member states, the Guiding Principle on Information Integrity that gives exactly the keys to reverse that situation. I'll take a last question and then we will go to UNHCR colleagues who have been waiting patiently. John Zarokostas.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for that. I was wondering first if you could send us the report. We haven't received it. I know you've got a launch event tomorrow.
You have not received it, John? Because
no.
I understand it was sent.
I only got the invitation for tomorrow's event. But thank you for that. I was wondering if you can give us some examples of smearing and even assassinations of women journalists by foreign governments for foreign policy or national security on where these journalists were perceived a national security threat by these governments, and they were either liquidated or smeared with big funds behind these smearing campaigns. Thank you.
Yes, and I'm reaching back here to the research that we produced for UNESCO over 3 years under the banner of the Chilling and other work that we've done, which is kind of reinforced through this new study for UN Women. So we included examples such as women journalists working for the BBC Persian service being targeted by the Iranian authorities extraterritorially. So this is one of the interesting and terrifying aspects of gender-based online violence, that it exposes the target to increased physical risk and it's extraterritorial, so it stretches across borders. And we know that, you know, there have been assassination attempts, physical assassination attempts against exiled Iranian journalists, for example. With a couple of examples from that group of women journalists working for the BBC, who for the Persian service, included online violence followed by deep fakes and even cheap fakes and printed out versions of these cheap fakes sent to the school of one of the women's sons. So the ways in which, you know, this stuff moves from online to offline and back again. We have also seen, in the case of Ukrainian women journalists, we've studied the use of these sorts of tactics by you know, Kremlin aligned actors. And then there is the case of Rada Ues, who is a senior reporter and presenter with Al Jazeera Arabic. She's Lebanese, she's based in Qatar. And we produced a big data case study on her, which the headline of which indicated that she was at the epicenter of a geopolitical storm online, and she was targeted. She alleges and had started legal proceedings to this effect by Saudi officials and by officials from a number of other Middle Eastern states. So it's part of this trend towards transnational repression that we're seeing targeting human rights defenders and journalists. And this, you know, this the online violence, gender-based online violence, is one of the essential tools in that toolkit deployed by the perpetrators. And that includes these foreign state actor-led attacks, but also we see it, as I mentioned, domestically within states that are tilting towards authoritarianism.
Thank you so very much.
Could I just make one?
Please.
Oh, sorry, Alessandra.
Thank you. No, but this would have deserved a separate press conference. I think it would have been really interesting. But anyway.
Thank you so much. I just wanted to sort of clarify that some of the examples Julia's sharing, she's an independent researcher, so they're not necessarily from the report that we're presenting today. We will be doing an analysis of perpetration to understand who the different actors are, and in one of the future reports, as Julie mentioned, there's three reports that are coming out as part of this series until we get to the final report, so there will be more information on the specific tactics and perpetrators, but some of the examples Julie has shared today are not necessarily from the UN Women research that we're presenting today. Thank
They're
you.
They're not, and I should add that I will share with you, if you like, for the press office, some of the published examples from the UNESCO work and from the work we've done with ICFJ, which can provide the data that you need to demonstrate the examples that you were seeking. But again, the report we're releasing today is the specific UN Women report. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I see that Sophia has answered the journalist in the chat that the report will be sent to everyone very, very quickly. So thanks to both our speakers and for this very informative briefing, and I'll ask our colleagues of UNHCR to come to the podium. Thank you. Matt, are you coming too? No? So thank you very much for being with us today. Matt has brought us Nicolas Bojas, who is the UNHCR chief of the Global Compact on Refugees section. I don't know who would like to start. Matt?
I'll hand it over to Nico in a moment. Just before he takes the microphone, to let you know that we have shared on embargo with you this morning our annual press release on the 2025 Nansen Refugee Award. So you should have that in your inboxes. That includes biographies of the laureates. There's one overall winner, as well as four regional winners this year, and it also includes multimedia assets. The Nansen Refugee Award was established in 1954, and it is presented every year to an individual group or organization that has taken extraordinary action to protect or assist forcibly displaced or stateless people. There will be next week an award ceremony that goes with the Nansen Award. That will take place on the 16th of December at 7:30 p.m. Here in Geneva. It'll be hosted by Leanne Manas, who's an award-winning senior news anchor from South Africa, and UNHCR's Goodwill Ambassador Kate Blanchett will be delivering remarks at that event as well.
That's on Monday.
That is on the 16th of December.
Oh, Tuesday, okay.
Yeah, and there'll also be performances by Ahmad Judeh, a stateless refugee who was raised in Syria, a dancer and choreographer, Tuse, a musician and singer from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and Maria Sur, a 20-year-old refugee singer and performer from Ukraine. The event will be open to all journalists who are registered at the Palais des Nations in Geneva, but do please get in touch with us if you would like to attend so that we can help facilitate that. Over to you, Nico.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Alessandra and Matt, and thank you for your patience. I will brief on the Global Refugee Forum Progress Review, which will be taking place next week in Geneva from the 15th to the 17th of December. This is a midway point between two global refugee forums, which take place every 4 years. The last one took place in Geneva in 2023. These forums are the main tools to implement and advance the Global Compact on Refugees, which is all about responsibility sharing and international solidarity to support countries hosting refugees and working towards lasting solutions to refugee situations. The meeting will be taking place over 3 days. We're looking forward to welcoming a wide range of stakeholders, which really represent the entire ecosystem, so to speak, of the Global Compact on Refugees. These, of course, include UN member states, UN entities, civil society actors, but also private sector, academia, faith leaders, and first and foremost, refugees themselves. And this is very much a meeting that is with them, about them, not because it's the right thing to do, but because it's the smart thing to do. And we are hoping to have at least some 200 people with lived experience of forced displacement and statelessness joining us in this event. And with the support of Switzerland and the United Kingdom, we will be able, UNHCR, to sponsor the participation of some 130 of those individuals. The meeting also will involve a series of side events and strategic dialogues. So we are hoping to be able to cover the main issues that are at stake today. I'm sure I will not break any news in explaining the main challenges that are faced today in terms of addressing forced displacement, starting by shrinking humanitarian assistance and overall official development assistance. The latest data that we've received from the OECD is quite bleak, and the outlook, the projections for 24-25 in terms of official data are not encouraging. All this information is available in the Global Compact on Refugees Indicator Report, which I believe has been made available to you all. But beyond financial constraints, what we're also experiencing, and I think the previous speakers spoke very eloquently about some of the challenges, it's around the political will to really respond to refugee situations. Multilateralism is questioned, if not attacked. And it's very important that we use this opportunity next week to really reaffirm our collective commitment to respond to support protection of refugees and working towards solutions. Many refugees are being scapegoated. We see also an increasing instances of hate speech, misinformation, and disinformation, and that will be one of the topics that will also be discussed during the event next week. The objective of the meeting is not to repeat another global refugee forum. It will be smaller in scale, yet we are expecting over 2,000 participants composed of different delegations, as I just explained. The main objective is about taking stock of commitments made since 2019, the first Global Refugee Forum, but most particularly since 2023, the last forum, and see how actors, ourselves all together, have been progressing in terms of implementing those commitments. But it's more than simply taking stock. It will be an opportunity to correct course, identify areas that require further investment, and pave the way towards the next Global Refugee Forum in 2027. Considering the context and the challenges, we know that many players, many actors, many civil society actors, refugees themselves, are looking to us to make this meeting count. And we are determined to make this meeting count indeed. Maybe just a few words in terms of what we'll be speaking about and what also will be made available to you in terms of findings of the stock-taking process. We've been able to gather data since 2016, roughly, and what we are seeing is when there is a will, there is a way, and international solidarity, collective action, do yield dividends. We have seen good progress in terms of support towards host countries, in particular low-income and middle-income countries. We have seen also the results of collective efforts when it comes to specific sectors, such as including refugees in national systems, allowing them access to jobs and labor markets, but also increasing efforts when it comes to third country solutions, not just through resettlement, but also through complementary pathways such as family reunification. When it comes to returns to home countries, which is also one of the key objectives of the Global Compact on Refugees, we have seen also improved engagement, especially when it comes to addressing some of the root causes, such as addressing issues linked to house, land, and properties. However, this is an area that requires a lot of and more sustained efforts, in particular when it comes to peace building. Now, this sounds positive. Unfortunately, the picture is not as rosy as that. And all the gains that have been reached over the past decade are at significant risk of being lost. Of course, this is linked to the financial situation and the bleak outlook, but also linked to the political will that we are experiencing these days. So next week, the event will be an opportunity to reaffirm our collective commitments to support refugees, to support host countries. It is an important milestone, but it's not the end of a journey. And let me be very clear, that even does matter because it will bring together a series of very important stakeholders, but it's not the end of the journey. And it's very important that we continue mobilizing support, including through you, the media, to really advocate and advance and mobilize champions of refugee protection. In particular, it will be very important when we look at the pledges that have been made in 2023 and the level of implementation. We are very encouraged with the momentum and the continued engagement. Over 3,400 pledges have been made since 2019. The vast majority were made in 2023. And based on the data that we have collected, and we're extremely appreciative to all stakeholders for reporting back to us, over 60% of those pledges have been fulfilled or are being implemented. And when I say pledges, these are not just financial pledges. They're also policy pledges, especially some pledges made by host countries to allow refugees to access labor markets, to include them in their national systems. Those policy pledges must be matched with financial support. And next week will be an occasion to reiterate this call and really make it happen to the extent possible. Now, just to conclude, and I'll be looking forward to answering some of your questions, because we've received some questions about the opportunity and of organizing such an event in this time. And I can tell you that many refugees, many civil society actors, many states are looking to us, UNHCR, to make this meeting count. And we'll do what we can to make it happen. I speak from the heart because I've been engaging with refugees themselves, and you know UNHCR is shrinking. We are faced with difficult financial situation, but I have so many local actors, refugee-led organizations that, as we speak, are effectively shutting down. And they're really looking to us to make this meeting count. So every commitment, every action, as small as possible, is essential. So the message from this GRF progress review is clear. Collective action works if we can sustain it, and we look forward to having you also at the event, which I understand will be open to the media. Thank you.
Indeed. Thank you very, very much. Let me see if there are questions in the room. Yes, Emma? Emma Farge, Reuters.
Yeah, just for news planning, it would be great to know when the big kind of Gandhi speech will be, I guess his last, and also whether we'll have a Q&A with him at some stage during the forum. And will there also be many big side events, and if there's a schedule, I'd love to see that. And finally, I think I know the answer to this, but let me just check. Will there be any leadership announcements at all or anything on the leadership contest during the forum? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Emma. The High Commissioner Filippo Grandi will be delivering opening remarks indeed, as well as closing remarks. The opening ceremony will take place on Monday the 15th at 10 a.m. The detailed program is available online, and we will make sure that the link is shared with you all. And the closing ceremony is scheduled to take place on the 17th of December at 4:30. There will be, and I will let Matt complement, there is indeed a media moment planned scheduled on the last day, but I will let Matt provide more details. As far as the next High Commissioner is concerned, we are, I think, all waiting eagerly for the announcement. I don't have more details to share at this point. Thank you.
Yeah, just to add, Emma, High Commissioner Filippo Grandi will be delivering remarks to the press. We'll be briefing with you on the 17th at the CICG, probably around 2:30, but we'll finalize that time, 2:30 CET. So do get your accreditation. That will be his last major media meeting under his mandate. We will be sending another advisory out to you. The details are being finalized in some aspects, so you'll get that soon in the next couple of days. And then in terms of the announcement of the next High Commissioner, I think as Nico said, this process is being completely managed by the United Nations in New York. So it's the office of the spokesperson of the Secretary General who is dealing with communications about that, and they will be making an announcement in due course.
Exactly, due course is the right word. But you wanted to say something about side events.
Yes, apologies. I think I forgot to answer that specific question. We have over 25 side events and strategic dialogues that are being scheduled that will be part of the official program. There are also additional linked events that will actually, that have started even this week, and that will span over the period of 2 weeks. It's, I don't want to go through the list now. You can go through the program, but it's a good mix of thematic issues, including on misinformation, hate speech, but also deep dives on specific situations. We will have a high-level event on Syria. We will also have one on Sudan, regional crisis. Both of them will take place on the third day, on the 17th. And we will also have one strategic dialogue on the Rohingya refugee situation. Thank you.
Are there hands up in the room? No, I don't see any. So John Zarukostas?
Yes, good morning and thank you. I was wondering if you could give us some details. There will be, I understand, a session on private philanthropy. When is that being held? Is that open to the press? And who will be the principal participants? And secondly, what are the guidelines of UNHCR, if you can refresh us, on receiving funds from the private sector? And if you've got a firewall, what you accept and what you don't?
Thank you for the question. So the private sector will be featuring throughout the event. We have, in terms of format, for each event and session, we have a series of panel. During the general debate and the plenary session, we'll have a specific session on access to employment for refugees. The private sector will be also featuring in the opening ceremony. I think your question on the specific event with philanthropists, this is one of the events that will take place in the margins of the GRF progress review. As far as, I will leave it to Matt as to what extent this event is open to the media. Otherwise, we can go back to you with more details. As far as your question in terms of UNHCR's accepting funds from the private sector,
the guidelines,
yes, we do accept funds from the private sector, but it follows indeed a very strict process whereby due diligence is carried out. We have clear operating procedures internally, so it's not automatic. We don't accept automatically such funds, but this is something done internally. And also we can, I'm sure, provide more details if needed. Matt, do you want to come?
Well, in terms of media access, the event is open. There may be one or two sessions that are behind closed doors. We don't have a full rundown of the exact breakdown, but in theory, these sessions should all be open to the media, and we do hope that you come along to cover it.
Thanks to both. Satoko Adachi, Yubiyo Shimbun.
Yes, thank you very much for doing this. I have a logistic question to Matt. Do we need an additional accreditation to cover the Global Compact at the CICG? Thank you.
Yes, we do ask you to make an additional accreditation via the Indico platform, but it should, I'm told, be quite painless and quick, could be famous last words, for accredited journalists. For the Nansen Award, if you're already accredited to UNOG, do just send us an email to let us know that you're coming, and particularly if you have any audio-visual requirements. We will, of course, be providing B-roll photos and the usual multimedia assets to go with both the GRF review, but also, of course, the Nansen Awards.
Thank you very much. I don't see other hands up, so thanks to both, and good luck for this important event next week. I have a few very quick announcements since this has been a very long briefing. Speaking about UN Women, there will be an event on Wednesday at 3:30, Reclaiming Digital Spaces, Women's Activism for Peace and Gender Equality. As I said, that's on the 10th of December, that in addition of being Human Rights Day, it's also the end of the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence. Orange, the world, I'm still wearing it. And so this will be in room 8 of the Palais des Nations. It's a joint event of UN Women, but also the Council of Europe and other partners. Also on the 10th, let me remind you of press conference of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Türk. That will be in this room at 10:30, and it's the traditional end-of-year press conference of the High Commissioner. Today, we are closing the 41st, sorry, today, no, but on Thursday afternoon, we are closing the 41st session of the Committee of the Protection of the Rights of All Migrant Workers and members of their families. And then I have two events to announce you, and I hope you'll be able to participate. One is tonight, at the 9th of December at 6:45 at the Cinerama Empire Cinema in town, the last Cine Uniu of the year. The movie that we will screen is called Igualada. This is a documentary movie on the current vice president of Colombia. Her name is Francia Márquez. She was called Igualada, which literally means outsider who dares to reach too high, to launch a campaign that has brought her to the vice presidency. We will screen the movie, followed by a discussion on the theme From Invisibility to Influence, How to Ensure that Political Participation of Marginalized Communities in Contemporary Democracies. And as usual, we will be waiting for you at the Cinema Empire, and this is a free event. I also wanted to remind you of another event which is taking place on the 15th of December. That's at 5:30 until 7 at the IBE premises, the International Bureau of Education premises. That's in Rue de Morillon. On the 15th of December, UNESCO International Bureau of Education will celebrate a defining moment of its 100-year history, the inscription of its historical archives into the UNESCO Memory of the World International Register. To celebrate this milestone, IBE will host a commemorative event at its premises in Geneva that are open to you. The evening will open with remarks from senior representatives of IBE, UNESCO, and the host country, Switzerland, followed by brief reflections on the enduring value of documentary heritage. And guests will witness the unveiling of a Memory of the World commemorative plaque. And that will be followed by a guided visit and mini exhibition. So please look at the invitation that we have sent you. There are all the information about the inscription, and you are welcome to participate in this event. And I think this is the last thing I wanted to tell you, except that I hope that at least at lunchtime, since this morning was not possible with the briefing, you'll be able to enjoy the beautiful bazaar in Assembly Hall. And as I said, this is organized by the UN Women's Guild, and every penny goes for projects in favor of women and girls. So thank you very much. And if there are no other questions for me, John has a hand up, sorry.
Yes, thank you, Alexandra. I've got a question actually for Mr. Galindo from IOM, if he's still there and listening in.
No, John, in fact, he was supposed to speak.
With the IOM report, they launched their appeal yesterday.
John, sorry, IOM, they were supposed to speak, but in fact they moved their briefing to the next one, to Tuesday. So I hope you'll be able to be there and ask questions directly to Mr. Galindo, or you can write to Mohammed Ali or to Kennedy.
No, it was just about the launch of their appeal yesterday. I had some questions on it, that's all.
Yeah. No, but I know he was supposed to talk today, but... UM was supposed to be here today, but in the end, they decided to come next briefing on Tuesday. So don't hesitate either to contact them or to ask the questions on Tuesday. Thank you very much. I don't see other hands up, so thanks everybody, and I'll see you on Friday. Thanks.